This is Functional Medicine Update for September 2000, Volume 19, Number 9. This month, we'll be covering a number of items on the general topic of practicing nutritional medicine. On Side 1, we begin with a report on nutritional therapy and bioavailability, followed by a look at osteoporosis and vitamin K intake. We will also review what you should know about the cytochrome P450 system. We will consider the 50-year progress towards solving sickle cell anemia. We will revisit the DASH study and update you on cardiovascular disease risk factors. Our interview on Side 2 is with this year's Linus Pauling Award recipient, Dr. Leo Galland. We conclude this issue with an extended report on zinc status and the many complex health factors it affects. Here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the September 2000 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
This is the month that our audio tapes become available from the 2000 annual symposium, our 7th International Symposium on Functional Medicine, and you'll all be receiving a written announcement over the tapes availability. But I just wanted to alert you to the fact that this month we're very pleased to have as our Clinician of the Month, Dr. Leo Galland, who was the Linus Pauling Award winner at the year 2000 symposium and whose clinical presentation at the meeting was considered one of the tremendous contributions to the overall curriculum and educational experience at our 7th International Symposium. So if you weren't fortunate enough to attend the meeting, I strongly urge that you get a copy of the tapes and have a chance to study and evaluate the information. There was a lot of news to use that was presented in May at our annual symposium. This month we're going to be focusing on the area of applied functional medicine in clinical practice, trying to get down to some of the how-to questions that often come up in the practice of a busy clinician. The first, of course, is that of nutritional therapies and are we getting what we're paying for? Is everything that we're providing the patient being utilized successfully, either from diet or supplements? And, of course, the question that is raised by that is bioavailability. As we know, it's no longer sufficient for nutritionists to prevent deficiency symptoms. And in fact, the vitamin deficiency diseases of beriberi, scurvy, pellagra, xerothalmy, or rickets are now replaced by different questions related to optimal levels of nutrition for defining then optimal health. In this context, the term chronic disease is invoked frequently, says Dr. Merritt Traber in his recent editorial in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition entitled The Bioavailability Bugaboo. Epidemiological and clinical data are touted to show that diets high in fruit and vegetables are beneficial for reducing the risk of heart disease and cancer, for instance. However, when single dietary components are tested in intervention trials using a pharmacological model, the results are, as we know, sometimes extraordinarily promising. They can be adverse or they can be neutral. For instance, we've seen the 77% decrease in second heart attacks in patients with coronary disease given vitamin E supplements, reported last year and described in Functional Medicine Update. Or we can talk about the 18% increase in lung cancer in smokers given beta-carotene supplements in the Finnish smokers trial, which again was a confounder that we discussed a number of years ago. Or we can look at other kinds of results that were ambiguous and really led to no demonstrable statistical effect when given a single nutrient against an endpoint of disease. Traditionally, the reversal of deficiency symptoms was used to assess nutrient requirements. However, as you know, we've become much more skilled in the biochemistry and molecular biology and its interrelationship with physiology, and therefore the precise physiological roles of nutrients have become the standard for setting requirements for optimal nutrition. This allows the quantitation for the relationship between a certain nutrient or group of nutrients and certain physiological functions or endpoints for evaluation. So now we've moved away from disdeficiency gross morphological signs, which may be the endpoint of deficiency, to more early warning signs looking at physiological function, as Dr. Mark Levine did in his vitamin C physiological studies looking at in situ kinetics of vitamin C in ambulatory metabolic ward individuals, in this case young men, finding that the level of vitamin C that was needed for metabolic function was much greater than that we had even seen in the recommended dietary allowances. And it led to the reestablishment and the debate around a new higher RDA level or RDI level for vitamin C based upon in situ performance kinetics, a biochemical marker. Well, then we ask the question, okay, if a person gets the nutrient into their mouth, either in a complex mixture in food or a multiple mixture in a nutritional supplement or as a single nutrient, can we assume that it has gotten to the point of action, i.e. promoted the physiological function that we're describing? Is it a one-to-one relationship? And of course, we all know the answer is no to that question. Bioavailability is really what we need to ask something about. Bioavailability is defined as the plasma concentration of a water-soluble substance given orally when the concentration of the drug is given intravenously. So it's a comparison of an intravenous level, same amount, versus an oral amount. The transfer of this concept from pharmacology to nutrition has been reasonably successful. For most of the water-soluble nutrients, particularly vitamin C, where extensive amounts of work has been done, but less so for the fat-soluble nutrients, ADE, the essential fatty acids, vitamin K, carotenoids, where unfortunately you cannot administer the fat-soluble nutrient intravenously, so the partition coefficient can't be as easily determined. Fat-soluble nutrients must be solubilized in micelles when they're digested, a process that depends on adequate bile and pancreatic secretions. Subsequently, the micelles transfer their contents to intestinal cells, and then the nutrients are packaged into chylomicrons, secreted into the lymph where the major absorption occurs rather than into the intrahepatic circulation, and transported ultimately to the liver. The chylomicron remnants, once cleared at the liver, then delivers the fat-soluble nutrients to various transport proteins, and these can vary, making this a much more complex process. For instance, vitamins A and D have very significant differences in the way that the transport proteins work. Vitamin A, as you know, is bound to retinol binding protein, which is secreted into the plasma and acts as a plasma carrier protein for vitamin A. This is to be contrasted to vitamin E, or alpha-tocopherol, which transfers in the liver to a alpha-tocopherol transfer protein, and then this occurs within the hepatocyte, but does not get secreted intact into the plasma. In fact, there's then a subsequent transfer from the transport protein of vitamin E in the liver to various lipoproteins where it's then transported in the plasma as a lipoprotein-bound vitamin E. So it's, again, a very complex process when we're talking about the plasma correlation to the oral amount as a measure of bioavailability. The fat-soluble nutrients, therefore, can be considered a difficulty. Let me give you an example. How about vitamin E with genetic defect in the tocopherol transfer protein in the liver? This is a genetic polymorphism that a few people have, and as a consequence, they cannot transfer vitamin E effectively in the liver to the lipoprotein so it doesn't get into the plasma. This leads to severe vitamin E deficiency at the normal dietary intake levels of vitamin E, extremely low plasma and tissue vitamin E concentrations, and progressive peripheral neuropathy. And this is one of the few examples where vitamin E tissue insufficiency has been associated with an overt pathology. How do you overcome this? Well, one way is to keep driving the mass action forward, even in overcoming the transport defect. So when patients who have this tocopherol transport protein deficiency are then given vitamin E orally in amounts 100 times the recommended dietary allowance, it's found these people can maintain normal plasma and tissue vitamin E concentrations, and the neurological symptoms are reversed or halted. This is also similar to what's found with cystic fibrosis individuals, in which malabsorption of vitamin E may be overcome by giving a more readily transportable form of vitamin E, the polyethylene glycol monosuccinate ester form of vitamin E, the water-soluble form of vitamin E that seems to be better absorbed and does not require the micellization and uptake into the lymph. It's more directly transported into the liver. So you'll notice that there are a variety of different complicating factors when we start talking about bioavailability of fat-soluble nutrients. It's also obvious that fat-soluble nutrients require some fat for absorption, in that fat tends to enjoy the company of fat. Recently, a paper was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, authored by Rudenberg et al., entitled Amount of Fat in the Diet Affecting Bioavailability of Lutein Esters but Not Alpha-Carotene, Beta-Carotene, and Vitamin E in Humans. This is American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Volume 71, page 1187 in year 2000. This study attempted to ask the question how much fat is necessary for the promotion of proper fat-soluble vitamin absorption. They studied the relative bioavailability of carotenoids and vitamin E in humans and reported that the lutein esters, but not other fat-soluble nutrients, are dependent on a higher fat diet content, 36 grams compared with 3 grams in a hot meal, for increased relative bioavailability. Study of the bioavailability and nutrient interactions also needs to be extended beyond that of just vitamin E and carotenoids to the flavonoids and other phytochemicals present in food that all interact one with the other and create different bioavailability partition coefficients. It's a very complex topic, obviously, of which we're just starting into an early understanding. This bioavailability problem seems to leave us with an endless number of unanswered questions presently. There's a tremendous amount of work that's necessary to be done. However, even in the face of not knowing all the answers, we can assume that bioavailability of specific nutrients is a cornerstone in determining the amount of any given nutrient for optimal health. And therefore, if we really want to establish optimal dietary levels, not just recommended dietary intakes, then we need to start asking the question not just what is the level of the nutrient, but what it is that is going to be absorbed in that individual to promote proper physiological function as measured as one or a group of specific physiological endpoints. You'll notice that this is why we do not have optimal physiological doses of nutrients yet, because all the questions are not in. It's an individualized question, and one of the things that you'll hear from Dr. Gallen this month in his interview is the importance of individualization of therapy due to this wide diversity in genetic polymorphisms and how it impacts then on nutrient uptake and utilization. An example of this that is recently in the news that I think is quite specific to a clinical problem is that of osteoporosis and vitamin K. We all know osteoporosis is a metabolic bone disease characterized by a defect in bone remodeling and the loss of normally mineralized bone. After age of 40, the slow phase of bone loss begins in both sexes and continues at a rate of about 0.5% to 1% per year until late in life. In women after menopause, however, there's an acceleration of the rate of bone loss, and it can be up to about 2 to 3% per year because of the decreasing estrogen concentrations. Osteoporosis, as you know, is responsible for about 1.2 million fractures in the United States annually and is considered a contributor as the 14th leading cause of death in women because of its effects on fracture that ultimately leads to hospitalization and other kinds of life-threatening conditions that occur post-fracture. The resistance to fracture is dependent upon bone mineral reserve or bone reserve. Generally, it's accepted that for most individuals, if they maintain bone reserve above 1 gram per square centimeter, that the normal wear and tear of life, the moving and trauma, the bumps and grinds of life will not create a fracture of the bone. If it falls below that threshold, however, below 1 gram per square centimeter, then an individual is at increasing risk to fracture in the spontaneous movements of life. It's not the little old lady who falls down and breaks her hip. It's the opposite. It's the woman who breaks her hip and then falls down as a consequence of the normal twists and tension and torsion on the bone that cannot be responded to by proper bone reserve. We recognize that at peak or top bone density, individuals have between 1.4 and 1.6 grams per square centimeter. So they're generally quite a bit above the threshold of bone fracture in their bone accretion maximum density years. After the age of 40, as I mentioned, there is a slow rate of loss or an accelerated loss in postmenopausal women that then makes the risk increasing for bone fracture. Well, we know that there are many nutrients that are involved with maintenance of bone integrity, both on the osteogenesis side, or bone reformation, and the osteolysis side, which is bone loss. And these include total energy intake, the nutrients that are needed to promote calcium incorporation within hydroxyapatite of bone include calcium and vitamin C, vitamin D, vitamin K, magnesium, boron, copper, manganese, zinc. And there are many genes for forming the appropriate bone density and integrity. Well, some of those are related to the metabolism of vitamin D. Vitamin D needs to be hydroxylated to 125 dihydroxy vitamin D in order to be active as a hormone in stimulating proper calcium uptake and utilization in osteogenesis. Vitamin D hormone receptors, estrogen receptors, transforming growth factor, beta, and interleukin 6 are also critical for normal bone metabolism and show genetic polymorphism. So clearly, there is a whole range of differing effects that nutrients can have on individuals related to bone integrity based upon their genetic uniqueness. Sporadic factors that contribute to osteoporosis and increase the risk of bone loss include things like smoking, excess alcohol intake, physical inactivity, overweight, certain genetic types like ApoE4 genotype, and the use of certain medications, such as anticonvulsant medications and anticoagulant drugs. Also, very high protein diets, a lot of caffeine in the diet. All of these have been implicated as potential risk factors for increasing bone loss. Medical conditions that exacerbate bone loss include Cushing's disease, hyperthyroidism, hyperparathyroidism, hypogonadism, because of ineffective steroid hormones that are related to anabolic effects on bone, and obviously malabsorption itself due to the poor absorption of these critical nutrients necessary for bone formation. What about vitamin K? Well, that's an interesting part of this genetic polymorphism story in bone integrity. Vitamin K, as you know, going back to your basic nutritional biochemistry, is required for the gamma carboxylation of glutamate. In this case, it's very important with two proteins that are induced by vitamin D hormone in bone, one of which is osteocalcin. Osteocalcin is a 49-residue protein with three carboxyglutamic acid residues, and it plays a very important role in adherence to bone mineral hydroxyapatite and secretion by the osteoblasts. Well, in a recent paper in 1989, Kanathan et al. Found that osteocalcin was undercarboxylated by 40% in postmenopausal women when compared with premenopausal women. The carboxylation of osteocalcin is dependent upon vitamin K status. The postmenopausal women responded to phylloquinone supplementation or vitamin K supplementation with an increase in total in carboxylated osteocalcin and a decrease in urinary calcium and hydroxyproline, meaning a lowered indication of bone loss in these women, postmenopausal women, when they were supplemented with vitamin K. Salk et al. Subsequently found that the incidence of hip fractures in aged women correlated directly with the increase in undercarboxylated osteocalcin, and the bone mineral density correlated negatively with the rise in undercarboxylated osteocalcin. In 1997, Shiraki et al. Found that postmenopausal women with an APOE4 genotype, this is the genotype that we've talked extensively about in Functional Medicine Update over the last few years, that interrelates with cardiovascular risk and dementia risk to Alzheimer's and has to do with altered lipoprotein transport processes, that the APOE4 phenotype had a lower bone mineral density than those with the APOE2 or 3. Some people call the double APOE4 the death gene, you recall, because it's associated with a shortened life expectancy because of these untoward effects related to biological aging. In addition, lowered vitamin K concentrations were found in patients with the APOE4 phenotype who had kidney problems and who were undergoing hemodialysis. And then we go to year 2000, a more recent paper that I think is quite fascinating following up on this work. This is the Booth, Tucker, and Chin study entitled Dietary Vitamin K Intakes Are Associated with Hip Fractures But Not with Bone Mineral Density in Elderly Men and Women. This is the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Volume 71, page 1201 in the year 2000. The mean bone mineral density in their study was 0.82 grams per square centimeter in men and 0.62 grams per square centimeter in women, obviously well below the 1 gram per square centimeter density that I described as important as the threshold to fracture. So these are in the fracture range. Of the 44 hip fractures reported in this study, 8 occurred in men and 36 in women. Once again, reminding us that osteoporosis is not solely a female problem, that it can also relate, obviously, to endocrine and metabolic dysfunctions in men as well. The point I'm trying to make from this review is that absorption of nutrients, the genetic polymorphisms, and metabolic utilization of nutrients is dependent upon a complex interaction, a symphony of different factors, and we should not jump, obviously, to a simple-minded cause and effect relationship between one nutrient and one outcome variable. There can be many things between the consumption of the nutrient and its ultimate effect on physiological function that participate in modifying the outcome of that function. Despite the limitations of these specific epidemiological studies related to vitamin K and osteoporosis specifically, obviously they do support a very important role of vitamin K in the retardation of bone loss in elderly people, particularly postmenopausal women who may be undercarboxylating glutamic acid in residues in osteocalcin and therefore have altered bone metabolism and accretion. So bioavailability, a very important part, interaction of complex nutrients, a very important part of the story in trying to determine optimal nutrition and certainly focused on the individual based upon their own genotype and not a nutrition for the average. Roger Williams said it beautifully when he said, nutrition is for real people. Statistical humans are of little interest. Well, what about other areas of genomic uniqueness? One that we have spoken to extensively in Functional Medicine Update over the last several years is the detoxification profiles, specifically the polymorphisms as found in the phase 1 cytochrome P450 superfamily of monooxygenase detoxifying enzymes. There's a recent paper that I found fascinating that appeared in the Journal of Gastroenterology and Hepatology, volume 12, page 415, in the year 1999, that asks the question, what should the clinician know about the cytochrome P450 system? Now, 10 years ago, this question wouldn't have even been asked in a journal article because it was considered such an esoteric question just on the bench of clinical biochemists doing esoteric research that it would never have been filtered into a paper for the general practitioner in hepatology or in gastroenterology. As a consequence, however, the last particularly 5 years of recognizing the genomic diversity of cytochrome P450s and how they interact with different drugs and give rise to untoward side effects as a consequence of cytochrome P450 2D6 polymorphisms or 1A2 polymorphisms or C21 polymorphisms. These different genetic types of detoxifiers may have vastly different effects in how they manage certain pharmacological agents and metabolize them by first-pass detoxification. As it goes on to say in this paper, the cytochrome P450s are a superfamily of enzymes catalyzing oxidation detoxification, thus transforming fat-soluble toxins into water-soluble metabolites, which are excreted in the urine. Cytochrome P450s are located mainly in the liver, where they play a role in reducing hepatotoxicity. Toxins or drugs, all going through the same detox system, may be in part transformed into reactive metabolites, the so-called reactive intermediates, which destroy hepatic proteins, resulting then in immune complex formation that then can create an immune reaction, immune-related hepatotoxicity, and therefore the proper transport and handling of various substances so they get biotransformed and then conjugated in phase 2 and then excreted can have a very important role in lowering what might be perceived as an antigenic burden by the body due to these incompletely metabolized substances, which then create an immune reaction that then ultimately results in immune complex formation and liver injury. It's a very interesting interrelationship, therefore, between toxins and the poor metabolism or detoxification of these toxins and activation of the immune system. Not obvious to an individual who may not know about this interrelationship between detoxification processes and antigenic production of these intermediary materials that are not completely detoxified. So again, the cytochrome P450, the genetic polymorphisms, how we detoxify, each of us individual in our response to the agents in our external and internal environment and the things that we may take as pharmacologically active agents and how they interact with metabolites, for instance, from colonic bacteria, which also require the same enzyme systems for detoxification, or endogenously produce steroid hormones that also vie for the same detox enzymes within our liver for elimination detoxification. A fascinating new advance in our understanding as to how genetic polymorphisms may play a role in what were previously called atypical reactions to the environment or atypical drug reactions. They're not atypical. In fact, they are typically reproducible in that individual if we understand their unique genetic polymorphism. So understanding more, analyzing more, evaluation more of these detox pathways helps us to better understand how to promote a person's appropriate function so they don't end up with immunologically active or oxidant stress reactive materials as a consequence of incomplete detoxification. Well, we're talking about molecular medicine, aren't we, and biochemical individuality. What about the concept that Roger Williams and Linus Pauling both advanced back in the 1950s? Actually, Dr. Pauling's article, Sickle Cell Anemia, a Molecular Disease, that appeared in Science Magazine in 1949 is considered a landmark in this area. And as we've talked about in Functional Medicine Update over the years, now we see that individuals carrying the sickle cell gene for the single amino acid substitution in the beta globin heavy chain of the protein that ends up in the sickling process, one can modify this phenotype by administering agents that upregulate the expression of fetal hemoglobin and things like hydroxyurea or butyrate have both been identified in clinical trials to increase the production in a person who carries the sickle trait of fetal hemoglobin, which is not sickled and dilutes out the sickled hemoglobin and prevents some of the packing problems of red cells that's found in the sickling crisis. Well, another interesting way of approaching what Dr. Pauling predicted would ultimately happen in his 1949 article, in which he said the discovery of mechanisms of molecular disease will open up new vistas for opportunity for therapeutics. Well, it's taken 50 years to get there, but I find another interesting paper was just published in the same area, knowing that some of the dysfunction that occurs as a consequence of the sickle crisis is destruction by oxidative stress of red cell membranes and producing then cells that undergo deformation, almost this echinocyte formation that occurs from oxidative damage of the red cell membrane. So you might say, could you modify the course of a sickle crisis through the administration of various kinds of oxidoreductive substances, so-called antioxidants? Dr. Gerald Lemieux, a number of years ago, published a paper in the Clinical Chemistry Journal, this is in the late 1970s, showing some preliminary data that antioxidant supplements did seem to prevent the severity of crisis and the recurrence of crisis in individuals carrying a sickle characteristic in their genes. A more detailed study was just published of the same type in the journal Nutrition, volume 16, page 330 in the year 2000. This is from the Philadelphia Biomedical Research Institute, Department of Biochemistry, University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. As we know, a certain population of red blood cells in patients with sickle cell anemia have elevated density and possess abnormal membranes as a consequence of oxidative damage. It's these dense cells that then have a tendency to adhere to neutrophils, platelets, and vascular endothelial cells, and thus are involved with triggering of the vaso-occlusion, the subsequent painful crisis from which sickle cell genotype-carrying individuals suffer. By developing a laboratory method of preparing such dense cells, it was found that nutritional antioxidant supplements given as, again, a family of antioxidant supplements to help quench hydroxyl radical formation and iron binding agents inhibits the formation of these dense cells in vitro. This might suggest, then, that the administration of nutritional supplements that contain the same array of nutrients and include aged garlic extract, black tea extract with its catechins and polyphenols, green tea extract, pycnogenol, which is the Pinus maritimus, pine bark concentrate, vitamin E, and coenzyme Q10 and beta-carotene, all given together, produced an in vitro effect on lowering the damage to red cells to produce these dense cells. Taking that information then, an ex vivo study in a pilot clinical trial demonstrated that a cocktail consisting of a daily dose of 6 grams of aged garlic, 4 to 6 grams of vitamin C, and 800 to 1200 IUs of vitamin E a day could be found beneficial in patients to reduce the prevalence of sickle crisis and lower these dense cells that are circulating in their plasma. So again, this is a preliminary study followed from an in vitro trial into an ex vivo study, then into a modest clinical pilot trial, demonstrating that in individuals with sickle cell characteristic that one could modify the course of these dense cell formations, which are associated with the vascular adhesion, by administering a complex mixture of antioxidants, 6 grams a day of aged garlic, 4 to 6 grams of vitamin C, 800 to 1200 IUs of vitamin E. Certainly a preliminary study, applied nutritional investigation, but again, looking at this modification of phenotype as a consequence of the nutritional environment in individuals with unique genetic genotypes. So modifying the outcome of the observables by utilizing nutrition at levels that are far different than that of individuals who do not have those specific genetic characteristics. The basis of what Dr. Pauling talked about as molecular medicine. We've been talking about bone and bone integrity. I think another place where this plays a significant role is those individuals who may go in for orthopedic surgery. I was very interested in the paper that appeared in The Lancet, volume 355, page 1499 in the year 2000, entitled Poor Bone Quality or Hip Structure as Risk Factors Affecting Survival of Total Hip Arthroplasty. There is a prevalence, a certain percentage of individuals who do not do well after hip replacement surgery. This paper points out that those individuals who do not do well are generally those individuals who had poor bone quality to begin with. Therefore, if one can, prior to surgery, do nutritional intervention, lifestyle intervention to improve bone integrity, bone density, the potential value of the surgery may be enhanced. In this particular paper, they go on to say that if one wants to ensure the durability of the replacement prosthesis and to get the maximum success in surgery, factors related to bone integrity, bone quality should be assessed, and that biological initiatives should be employed to resolve problems related to poor bone integrity. It comes back to how functional nutritional medicine can play a role in both optimizing the success of a traditional surgical procedure or even prevention of the need for some of these crisis interventions. Diet is a very powerful regulator of gene expression in many cases, and once you start looking at the data that is published from this perspective, using this lens, it leads to a whole different interpretation of the role that nutrients, both macro and micronutrients and conditionally essential nutrients, have on phenotypic outcome. I was interested when I re-looked at the DASH study. As you probably know, we talked about the DASH study, which is the Dietary High Blood Pressure Education Program study, looking at how salt and nutrients in the diet, such as calcium, magnesium, potassium, influence blood pressure. On May 17th, Dr. Claude Lafont, director of the National Heart, Lung, Blood Institute, declared the controversy concerning salt over. The results of the DASH sodium, which was the new follow-up of the DASH study, found that although there was some value from salt restriction, that by far and away the greater value in lowering blood pressure was a dietary intervention to improve potassium, calcium, and magnesium intake. And this, I think, supports strongly the precepts and work of Dr. David McCarron at the Oregon Health Sciences University, who for years has been talking about the importance of increasing calcium, magnesium, and potassium, not just focusing on sodium restriction when trying to lower blood pressure. DASH stands, by the way, this is D-A-S-H, stands for the Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension. Everybody has to have an acronym. So the Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension research seems to indicate that although salt restriction may have some benefit, that certainly calcium, magnesium, and potassium increase is more important in lowering blood pressure. In fact, the control diet group reduced blood pressure in the DASH study by 5.6 and 2.8 millimeters mercury, respectively, systolic, diastolic. It seems to be as effective as most first-generation antihypertensives. They're suggesting by application of the DASH study results that this may be a remedy for control in blood pressure for nearly half of the individuals who are suffering from essential hypertension. If we can just administer diets that are consistent with the DASH study guidelines that can be complied with and are tasty and lead to long-term patient management. Cardiovascular disease, obviously, is an outcome from elevated blood pressure, hypertension. And so we might ask the question, what about the other variables, the other risk factors we've been describing, extended risk factors for cardiovascular disease? One of those was inflammatory mediators, such as elevated levels of high-sensitivity C-reactive protein, or CRP. I want to emphasize once again that those of you who may be looking at CRP levels on a standard blood analysis and trying to assess the risk in your patients to cardiovascular disease based upon this parameter are probably looking at the wrong bit of data upon which to make a decision. Most of the laboratories are still utilizing as their standard CRP test the low sensitivity CRP, which is not sensitive enough to pick up these markers at an early state for inflammatory connections to heart disease. You need to use the high sensitivity CRP, which is now that which is being developed. In fact, there was a comparison of four automated high-sensitivity CRP methods that was just published in Clinical Chemistry, Volume 46, page 461, in the year 2000, in which they show that the four high-sensitivity CRP methods exhibited differences in results for a healthy population, and that they call for additional standardization efforts to ensure that the high-sensitivity CRP results can be related to the epidemiological study showing that elevated CRP is associated with cardiovascular risk. So your laboratory providing this data as high-sensitivity CRP should have good internal quality control, quality assurance data, upon which the clinical interpretation can be built. So if you're doing CRP analysis, make sure it's high sensitivity and inquire in the laboratory how their normal ranges and values were determined. It's interesting to note that the inflammatory mediators associated with cardiovascular disease at the cell physiological level seem to be associated with increased levels of intercellular adhesion molecule 1 or ICAM-1, increased monocyte adhesion to the arterial endothelium, transmigration of the white cell then into the anterior wall of the endothelium, which then can undergo transformations, ultimately leading to the oxidation of LDL and participating in the atherogenic process. So stickiness of white cells to arterial endothelium increases then the risk to heart disease, and this is associated with increased inflammatory mediators. Well, we talked a little bit about pine bark pycnogenol. An interesting paper was just published out of the laboratories of Dr. Lester Packer and his colleagues at the University of California, Berkeley, looking at the pine bark extract pycnogenol and its influence on inducible intracellular adhesion molecule 1 expression. And in this particular study, they indicated that pine bark pycnogenol downregulated interferon gamma-induced adhesion of T cells to human keratinocytes and does so as a consequence of inhibiting the production of inducible form of ICAM. In other words, it downregulates the gene expression of ICAM-1. Another example of a nutrient, a conditionally essential nutrient, possibly influencing gene expression and altering phenotype, in this case, adverse effects related to stickiness of white cells to endothelial surfaces. Now, again, I want to emphasize that this particular study is an in vitro study. One should not jump immediately to any kind of clinical outcome conclusion, but it seems to correlate with some of the observed effects that individuals have noted clinically on individuals who have supplemented with pine bark pycnogenol. One of those has to do with peripheral vascular difficulties, peripheral vascular resistance, and problems with regard to vascular circulatory problems in individuals with diabetes, healing of aphthous ulcers, problems related to skin tone texture in extremities, particularly the feet, in diabetics that have been supplemented with pycnogenol who have seen significant improvement in what appears to be the texture and tone of the skin and the healing of ulcers and the resistance of the skin to lesions. So this may help explain at a physiological mechanism what has been observed at a clinical level. A lot more work needs to be done, but I think it's quite fascinating showing how pycnogenol may influence skin inflammatory process and may help in the healing process and reduction of some of the untoward vascular effects associated with ICAM-1 expression, inducible ICAM-1 expression. By the way, that last paper I'm describing from Dr. Packer's group, you'll find in the journal Free Radical Biology and Medicine, volume 28, page 219 in the year 2000. Another vascular risk factor, extended risk factor we've discussed extensively is plasma homocysteine. And it's very interesting. A number of recent papers have been published showing that plasma homocysteine is a better marker for early stage dementia-related problems and psychosocial performance difficulties in a geriatric population than is serum methylmalonic acid. We've often spoken about the importance of methylmalonic acid, but in a recent paper, again, Clinical Chemistry, Volume 46, page 691, in the year 2000, it was found that plasma homocysteine actually better correlated as a marker for socio-psychological performance in a geriatric population than did methylmalonic acid. So if you're looking for B6, B12, folate markers, then it appears, again, that methylmalonic acid may be secondary to that of plasma homocysteine. Plasma homocysteine is also very closely correlated with copper in patients with peripheral vascular disease. And you might recall that Dr. Leslie Clivet at the USDA Grand Forks, North Dakota Research Station has for years talked about the copper connection to heart disease, to vascular disease, saying that hypercupremia is associated with risk to heart disease. And it appears as if that high copper is also associated with high homocysteine. Whether there's a cause and effect relationship is yet to be fully defined, but the findings in this study certainly indicate that atherogenicity of homocysteine may be related to the copper-dependent interactions, and that this may be another part of the story, that there's a relationship between high homocysteine and the release of copper from stores that induces an oxidative stress. This appeared again in Clinical Chemistry, Volume 46, page 385 in the year 2000, the connection between homocysteine elevations and elevated copper levels. We also recognize that individuals who consume a considerable amount of distilled spirits and beer have increasing risk of vascular disease at certain excessive intake levels. And it's fascinating, a paper that was just published in The Lancet, volume 355, page 1522 in the year 2000, showed an inverse relationship between homocysteine levels and vitamin B6 levels in individuals who consume different kinds of alcoholic beverages. The higher the alcohol intake, the lower the B6 level, and the higher the homocysteine level. So it seems to suggest that there is an interrelationship between vitamin depletion of certain of the nutrients necessary for metabolism of homocysteine, elevation of homocysteine, and the potential contribution that elevated homocysteine has on atherogenic risk. Isn't this fascinating when you start looking at patterns and interactions and don't just jump to simple one-on-one conclusions that in this case B6 and folate and B12 may be interrelated, therefore, to homocysteine as a consequence of alcohol consumption, which increases their metabolism and release from the body. This is further confirmed in a wonderful review paper that appeared in Nutrition, Volume 16, page 296 in the year 2000, entitled Hyperhomocysteemia in Chronic Alcoholism, Relationships to Folic Acid and B6 and B12 Status, in which, again, they show that the increased risk of heart disease in people who are alcohol abusers may be associated with the depletion of these B nutrients that are necessary for proper metabolism of homocysteine. So the connection may be indirect between alcohol and heart disease through a hyperhomocysteemia connection due to vitamin B depletion. A fascinating story. So if you're looking at individuals who are consuming high levels of alcohol and trying to determine vascular risk, one might look at homocysteine levels to see if it is elevated as a marker for cardiovascular risk. Well, that leads us then to other biological response modifying nutrients that have effect upon gene expression. A series of nutrients that Dr. Gallen will be speaking about are the omega-3 fatty acids. And you recall that it was back in 1985 in the New England Journal of Medicine that the paper was published from Elias Corey's group et al. From Harvard Graduate Department of Chemistry and the medical school that was talking about the role of eicosapentaenoic acid, or EPA, the fish oil principle, and its reduction in monocyte leukotriene formation and neutrophil formation. The 5-lipoxygenase enzyme was reduced in activity, and there were lower numbers of these reactive intermediates when individuals were supplemented with fish oils, and how that then could influence potential inflammatory process. Well, a lot has happened since 1985. Dr. Joel Krimmer and many other rheumatologists have gotten involved in this and supplemented patients with EPA who had clinically defined rheumatoid arthritis, and against placebos looked at the outcome and saw increased range of motion and lowered pain and swelling and lowered use of voluntary pain medication. And therefore, it now is recognized that omega-3 fatty acids may modulate the progression of certain forms of arthritis. I'm now quoting from a more recent paper in the Inform Journal, Volume 11, page 410 in the year 2000. It was entitled, Omega-3 Fatty Acids Modulating the Progression of Arthritis. And as you know, throughout history, arthritis has been one of the major chronic diseases. In the United States, approximately 15% or 40 million people have arthritis. In the older age population, 65 years or older, this debilitating condition is estimated to cost about $65 billion a year in medical expenditures. Osteoarthritis and rheumatoid arthritis are the two most common forms of arthritis that we've discussed. Both are associated with the release of inflammatory mediators from the leukotriene family and from other pro-inflammatory mediators that come through IL-1 and tumor necrosis factor alpha modulation and activation of the arachidonic acid cascade. We've talked extensively in Functional Medicine Update about cyclooxygenase 1 and cyclooxygenase 2 and the new drugs that are being used to suppress cyclooxygenase 2 without influencing cyclooxygenase 1 and the relationship that has then to changing the inflammatory process within the cell. But we've talked less about modulating leukotrienes, which are other pro-inflammatory mediators coming from arachidonic acid. In fact, leukotrienes are about 1,000 times more pro-inflammatory than histamine. And we all know about antihistamines, but we don't talk as much about the anti-leukotrienes. Well, omega-3 fatty acids are anti-leukotrienes, and they have a very important role to play, says this paper, in helping to produce the benefit in this particular type of outcome with patients that have either osteo or rheumatoid arthritis. We know that EPA and DHA, the fish oil principles, have differential effects on serum lipids and lipoproteins and can also lower the levels of LDL cholesterol in certain individuals and triglycerides. They also can influence insulin sensitivity. This appears to occur as a consequence of the role they have in being modulated by the peroxisome proliferated activated receptors alpha and gamma. The PPAR gamma family has to do with insulin sensitivity. The peroxisome is the organelle, as you know, that's involved with the metabolism of very long-chain fatty acids, and therefore
The fish oils are very important in helping to sensitize and stabilize peroxisome metabolism and PPAR gamma sensitivity. They're agonists of PPAR gamma, and therefore they have an effective role in triglyceride management, cholesterol management, and in insulin management, according to American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Volume 71, page 1085, in the year 2000. So peroxisome proliferated activated receptors, how the liver functions, are going to be in part related to the dietary intake of various fats. Long-chain saturated fats are antagonists of PPAR gamma, whereas the polyunsaturated omega-3 fatty acids are agonists and can help improve insulin sensitivity and lipid management. There's a whole series of papers that describe this, including the Journal of Lipid Research, Volume 41, page 719, Carcinogenesis, Volume 21, page 823, and Journal of Lipid Research, Volume 41, page 814, that all talk about the role that omega-3 fatty acids have in affecting lipid metabolism and insulin sensitivity, and the difference between a PPAR gamma activator and a PPAR alpha activator. Let's move to our Clinician of the Month on Side 2.
Well, we're at that place once again, our Clinician of the Month portion of FMU that most of you really look forward to as the highlight of each month's series. We're very fortunate to have our recipient of the 6th International Linus Pauling Functional Medicine Award, Dr. Leo Gallen. Many of you know Dr. Gallen both personally and professionally from his years of contribution. In fact, we're very pleased in that he has been a recurring guest to Functional Medicine Update, having been on our tape series in November of 1993 and then later March 1995. And it was amazing that it's been 5 years since Leo was with us last. And I guess 5 good years, because many, many positive things have happened to both the field and to Dr. Gallen and his contributions to the evolution of the field. Just to let you know a little bit about Leo, he is an MD from the New York University School of Medicine. He got his undergraduate degree at Harvard, internship at Bellevue Hospital in New York, residency at Bellevue New York University Medical Center, has served as an instructor in clinical medicine at the Albert Einstein School of Medicine and an assistant professor of community medicine and family medicine at the University of New York Stony Brook, and assistant clinical professor of medicine at University of Connecticut. He has been at the Gassell Institute, been in private practice for many years, and would be considered by all of us who have been in this field for a number of years to be a founding member of the Institute for Functional Medicine and a leader in nutritional medicine. So with great clinical background and I would also call it research contribution with a very hefty publication record, and also the author of 2 best-selling books, his most recent one, 4 Pillars of Healing or Power Healing, is one of those scholarship books that really raises the whole level of understanding of this emergent field of integrative medicine. It's with great pleasure that I introduce you to Dr. Leo Gallen. And Leo, thanks for being with us once again.
Well, it's always a pleasure to speak with you, Jeff.
Let me, if I can, just quickly highlight a few of the many, many things that I've learned from you over the years, just to give our listeners a sense of the breadth of your interests and contributions. As far as I'm concerned, you're the first person that I really learned about parasitology in the Western world. And, you know, this, we always thought of maybe parasitology as being something you would see in developing countries with poor sanitation and hygiene than in the Western world. But you certainly got us to understand aspects of parasitology and gut infection in the more developed countries of the world and how that presents itself in clinical symptoms. You were the first person that I recall to really bring onto the marquee at a higher level of understanding the biological response agents like fatty acids, and going way back to the early stage with Dr. Don Rudin and David Harobin doing collaborative work and helping us understand the precursors of fatty acids to the prostanoids. The whole relationship of gut permeability and gut ecology really is, I think, been brought on the marquee as a consequence of your education, writing, and clinical work. Cellular mediators and how they have action at a distance was an area that you talked about very early on that I think we can attribute to your insight. Immunonutrition was an area that was actually the focus of your first book, as I recall, and when you're dealing with pediatrics, an area of your emphasis and contribution. Of course, children's behavior, the whole work that you did starting at Gassell or maybe even starting before that and continuing on over the many years. So that's but a small list of the breadth of things that I think we can attribute to Dr. Gallen and helping all of the rest of us to understand the importance of these areas. If you were to look back, Leo, and kind of characterize, you know, going to the stern of your ship and look at the wake, how would you characterize the path that you've been on from being an academic medical professional to moving now into this integrative medicine field as a clinician?
The way things really started for me, Jeff, was through a kind of perfectionism. That is, I just didn't like the results that I was getting in applying what I've been trained to do as an internist through my residency. And so I started out by trying to figure out how I could just be a more effective clinician. And I think the first really important lesson that I learned was to try and grasp and understand the individuality of each patient. And of all of the principles that I think that guide the field that we're in, I think that's really the first, is the recognition of the individuality of each patient from a psychosocial perspective, and as Roger Williams had taught us years ago, from a biological perspective. In part, that requires two things, which we often don't speak about in our meetings. One is really being present during the interview, giving the patient your attention, trying to understand, who's this person that I'm speaking to? What's going on with them? That has to happen independently of lab tests and medical diagnoses. And patients know that you're doing that. I mean, they really respond in a very positive way to it. I mean, that's a start, but it's not enough. Then you have to start to acquire a database of information that you can apply to the recognition of the individuality of the person. And I guess what I started doing back in the late 70s was looking for scientifically based information that would help me understand each person as an individual. The task is a lot easier today. Actually, you've contributed to making it easier because you've pulled so much useful information together. You know, back around 1980, it was just a wilderness out there. I probably spent as much time with my second medical education as I had with my first, going to meetings, reading books and journals, and trying to rethink the whole process of illness as it affects individuals. What I came up with that was really practical and that really helped me in guiding patients, and that the feedback that I've gotten from people that I've taught over the years has been consistently positive about, have been principles that went into the book, Power Healing, basically the principles of the four pillars of healing, which have to do with, number one, establishing a good doctor-patient relationship, which begins with being really present in the interview, listening carefully to patients. That is so therapeutic on its own. Next, looking at nutrition, and the nutritional principles that I consistently find to be very important over and over again, even in patients that I'm seeing who have been to other nutritional physicians, I just haven't found anything that really displaces these in general, have been, first of all, recognizing that people have different dietary requirements. There isn't one diet that fits everybody. So once you've pruned away all of the, you know, the junk food, which doesn't benefit any of us, that you really need to be tuned into the fact that aside from food allergies, there are people who thrive on higher protein, lower carbohydrate intake, and people who are totally the opposite. And by paying attention to the reports that patients have given me about their experiences with food and what food has meant to them and how different dietary changes have affected them, and by being very careful in my follow-up of patients and seeing how they've done with the recommendations that I've given them, I have developed a way of individualizing general dietary advice. And I have found that follow-up is really important. I think it's very difficult to see somebody, do an evaluation, give them a program, and tell them to come back in 3 months or 6 months and you'll see how they're doing. Especially with the patients that I see who are pretty complex and have been ill for a long time. I think that regular frequent follow-ups, so you can see how the person has done in response to the recommendations that you've made, are really important to adjusting and fine-tuning the program, and especially the nutritional program. Then there are certain specific nutrients that over and over again wind up being very important. Essential fatty acids is one critical area. There aren't a whole lot of choices with regard to supplementation in this area. They're omega-3s and omega-6s. Statistically, the majority of people in the developed world have a shortfall of omega-3s because of food choices and food processing, but there are maybe 15% of individuals who have difficulty utilizing the omega-6s. When I first started researching this and lecturing about it around 1980, I had to explain what an essential fatty acid was. Today there's so much information out there. It's been really gratifying to me to see the increased awareness of the importance of these. The second area, just as important, has been calcium and magnesium balance, and especially magnesium. There are fairly widespread deficits in magnesium, which are not only due to underconsumption, but to the effects of stress on the body's magnesium economy. I have seen so many patients who have benefited from magnesium replacement that I couldn't begin to count them at this point. There are certain symptoms and signs that I found to be helpful in guiding therapy, and to be more helpful than laboratory tests, actually. With regard to the essential fatty acids, the presence of dry skin, soft or brittle nails, dry hair, excessive thirst, rough skin, called follicular keratoses, and they're often found on the backs of the arms and sometimes on the face as well. These are symptoms of an unmet need for essential fatty acids in the majority of people who have them. And even if my therapeutic intention in treating someone, let's say with a supplement of fish oils or a flax oil, is to control and help the person control an inflammatory process, paying attention to how these relatively unimportant, medically unimportant symptoms respond to the fatty acid has really been helpful to me in making decisions about whether they're taking too much or the wrong kind. I mean, for example, someone with arthritis is taking fish oils. Their arthritis isn't particularly getting better, but their skin is actually getting drier. It's getting excessively dry. That's a good sign that although the literature says fish oils may symptomatically help rheumatoid arthritis, for example, or osteoarthritis, that what is being accomplished with this pattern of dietary supplementation is really aggravating a problem with omega-6 metabolism, and that in fact this is someone who may need to add or switch to a source of gamma-linolenic acid for control of arthritic symptoms. I found that that kind of balancing based upon an individual's symptoms and physical findings has been really helpful. I also find that it works a lot better than using fixed combinations that say, well, everybody has to have a certain amount of GLA in proportion to a certain amount of EPA. People just aren't all the same that way in their nutritional needs. Similarly, with magnesium and with calcium, I mean, there is no good laboratory test for calcium balance in the body. Magnesium in serum, in red cells, in hair, in white blood cells, all of those tissues handle magnesium differently. They don't actually correlate well at all. So although I measure magnesium in serum and I measure magnesium in red cells and occasionally in hair, I don't find that I can rely on those results as well as I can upon the clinical symptoms and the clinical response. The clinical symptoms that point to a shortfall of magnesium are difficulty falling asleep, irritability, sensitivity to loud noises, a tendency towards muscle twitches or muscle cramps or muscle spasm, or extreme anxiety, and also palpitations, especially if there is no cardiovascular disease or hyperthyroidism or some other condition which would produce the palpitations. People with that constellation of symptoms, and there are many of them, usually respond very well to magnesium supplementation, whatever the laboratory tests say. I've actually seen people who had very low red cell magnesium who did not respond to magnesium supplements the way I would have liked at all. So I find the symptom guide to be the first one to use. But then it's necessary to follow up with the person. There are people who have paradoxical reactions to nutrients given in a way that would seem to be appropriate. And I've found as a clinician I need to know this. Someone who's cramping, for example, actually becomes worse when they're supplementing with magnesium, may have a problem with calcium or potassium. Magnesium supplements, by lowering parathyroid levels, which is generally beneficial, may be aggravating the calcium problem. I try to incorporate these very simple kinds of clinical decisions, which can have very powerful effects in people, into the writing of Power Healing as far as making decisions go. Those are the nutritional areas that I've really found to have the most consistently important effects. In addition, of course, there's the extensive work that's been done with antioxidants of various types, the bioflavonoids, and some of the newer phytochemicals. I think there's great promise there for the development of useful therapies. I don't feel that we've developed a mastery of how they can be best used. I often find that the research literature promises better results than I find in clinical practice. But I use them considerably, especially among people who have allergic or inflammatory disorders, and sometimes find them very helpful. I may use them even if I don't find a symptomatic improvement, because I know that these patients are under a lot of oxidant stress, and so I want to support the antioxidant defense system. In the course of working with nutritional supplements, originally I found patients who did not seem to respond to nutritional supplements and who needed IVs. And so in the early days, I was doing a fair amount of IV therapy and some IM nutritional therapy. When I started investigating the role of the GI tract in chronic illness, I found that if people were not responding to nutritional therapies, or if they had a whole separate constellation of symptoms that pointed to gut problems, if I treated the gut problems first, I didn't need to resort to parenteral nutrition to help those patients along. And so consequently, over the past, it's about 11 or 12 years now, most of the research and most of the teaching that I've done has focused on the important role of the gastrointestinal tract in restoration of health. It's brought me back to some of the principles of the early naturopathic physicians. Here again, when looking at GI problems, I found that there was no program that worked for everybody, and a good deal of individualization was necessary. Part of the individualization goes into recognizing food allergies and being able to eliminate allergenic foods, but there's a sort of more profound level of individualization, which is very similar to the nutritional issue of looking at macronutrients. Those patients who do better on high-protein diets, those patients who do better on high-carbohydrate diets, whether it's complex carbohydrates or diets that contain a lot of fruit and natural, simple carbohydrates. When it comes to the gut, there are patients with chronic gastrointestinal symptoms and usually systemic symptoms as well. The GI symptoms will include altered bowel habits, constipation or diarrhea, gas, bloating, distension, discomfort, possibly with reflux symptoms, often with systemic symptoms that may include chronic fatigue, various muscular skeletal problems, including frank arthritis, and brain fog, and then symptoms which affect the skin. For those individuals, it's important to try and develop a perception of what might be going on in the gut that's impacting on their overall health. In reviewing the research literature and then looking at my clinical experience, I came up with a couple of concepts which continue to be quite helpful to me in clinical practice. And the fundamental concept is one of intestinal toxicity. Then that can be divided into two parts. There's the whole notion of leaky gut. And this still isn't really very well understood by clinical practitioners in my experience. The leaky gut concept is an increase in the permeability of the small intestine. That can be measured. And that permits macromolecules and certain types of otherwise insoluble toxins to enter the body with a number of different consequences. Not everybody who has chronic GI symptoms has a leaky gut. And you can't necessarily make that diagnosis by clinical criteria. The other concept, equally as important, maybe more important, is the concept of dysbiosis. Symbiosis, which is the root word, is a Greek word that means living with. We live with about 100 trillion bacteria in our guts, several thousand yeasts, and most people in the world live with one form of parasite or another, and actually humans have lived with worms for a million years. So symbiosis has many beneficial effects, or let's just say that our gut immune systems have evolved in the context of this symbiosis. Dysbiosis, or a dyssymbiosis, occurs when the symbiosis has negative effects on the person, and deficiency of beneficial bacteria and overgrowth of candida, bacterial overgrowth, or the wrong protozoa or metazoa growing in the gut for that individual are all part of the pattern of dysbiosis. And it's not necessarily the same for everybody. And the symptoms are not specific. And many people can have more than one component of this dysbiosis at a time. Evaluating this is a real challenge. And I have to say that stool testing through a really good laboratory, especially for parasites and secondarily for yeast, can be very helpful. But once again, it's the patient's history and their clinical responses that are more helpful. If someone has developed symptoms in the context of taking lots of antibiotics, that has one set of implications. If, on the other hand, antibiotics actually improve the symptoms, that has a different set of implications. The dietary requirements of people with these different forms of dysbiosis may differ. I would say that there are two dietary patterns that are used widely by nutritionally oriented physicians. One is the high-protein, low-carbohydrate pattern. And modifications of that will work very well for some people with dysbiosis that is due to excessive gut fermentation, which may involve either bacterial or yeast overgrowth in the small bowel, a condition that's very difficult to measure in a laboratory. The other approach is the more naturopathic approach of high-fiber, high-complex carbohydrate diets. And those can actually be disaster for people with excessive gut fermentation, but they will work very well for people who have an excessive pattern of putrefaction in the colon and who are producing large quantities of ammonia, who, because of their previously high protein diets, have actually had the bacteria have begun to increase their production of enzymes that alter amino acids and proteins. And so from a high-protein, high-fat Western diet, they've actually altered the bacterial populations in the gut. For those patients, an increase in fiber and a decrease in fat and protein can be very beneficial. Now, obviously, there's not enough time for me to go into this in detail in our discussion today, but I would say that that has been one of the major challenges that I've encountered in working with chronically ill patients. And it's also one of the features of those patients that has tuned me in more and more to the importance of looking at how a patient responds to therapeutic interventions rather than adhering to a single treatment protocol based upon an initial evaluation.
Leo, when you received the Linus Pauling Functional Medicine Award in front of your 600 peers, I was there for the exciting moment of celebration and recognized that your peers certainly acknowledge your leadership in the field and stood in unison and in applause for your receipt of the award. I got thinking, how does a doctor coming into this field start down this path? You have now 30 years of experience in this field. It probably is overwhelming to the early acceptor or individual who has just moved into the field to think, wow, this person knows so much and they've come so far, and how can I ever get started? And then you've also talked about the necessity to kind of retrain ourselves from that which we learned in our formal training, then go on and take a kind of this other curriculum, which sometimes is a curriculum that you have to self-design and implement. So it may be daunting for these poor
people that want to get in but don't know how to start. So when can a doctor act without really having complete knowledge? There's maybe that concept of, I'm not sure if I'm ever going to be competent enough to do anything.
You know, I think there are a number of very simple, straightforward steps that can be taken, although it does start with the evaluation of the person. If we take the functional medicine perspective in particular, first step is find out what this person is eating and what nutritional supplements they're taking. For the majority of people in this country, just finding strategies for cutting junk food out of their diet and eating a diet of higher nutritional density and then supplementing it with basic nutrient supplement package that includes about 10 times the RDA of most of the B vitamins, 800 micrograms of folic acid, which is not 10 times the folic acid RDA, some trace minerals, checking on their magnesium levels, looking for the symptoms of essential fatty acid deficiency, and having people supplement with some flax oil or fish oil. That's a very reasonable way to begin with patients. The challenge there, of course, is going to be compliance on the patient's part. What will happen as you start doing this is you'll find you will begin to attract, because there's so much interest in nutritional medicine, doctors who listen to their patients and are interested in their diets and in the supplements that they're taking and are willing to render even a simple nutritional prescription will begin attracting patients who want this approach. So the compliance of patients with the recommendations will begin to go up as new patients come in. The next thing is to make sure that you see them within a relatively short period of time, 2 to 4 weeks, and see what changes they've made and what has happened to their symptoms, to the way that they feel having made these changes. I think that's something that doctors don't need a lot of training to be able to do beyond their medical background. The rewards of doing that will be enough that it'll be possible to get started and then begin deciding, okay, where are the, where you learn from your problems, actually. During the first year of doing this, you'll probably learn most from your successes. That is, the people that come back and say, hey, I'm really feeling well, I feel a lot better, this improved, that improved. Keep track of what it is that got better with this patient and what they did. And you'll get a feeling for the patients that you're treating in your population and what you do that really seems helpful. And so you'll build on that knowledge. After about a year, start paying more attention to the people that get worse or that don't get better, to the mistakes. Because at a more advanced level, people learn better from negative feedback. This didn't work. This was wrong. Okay, well then, what was wrong about it? Where can you go for information that helps you with that? Well, here's a start. I mean, Preventative Medicine Update is a start on that. I am confident that over the next year or two, we're going to see the development of teaching sources for doctors that will guide practical treatment decisions in this area.
I think one of the other things you've contributed that is extraordinarily valuable to a new doctor coming into this field, new practitioner, is the whole concept of how to evaluate the patient based on what you've called patient-centered assessment, looking at antecedents, triggers, mediators, signs, and symptoms, versus focusing solely on the diagnosis and the medical taxonomy. I think that perspective also is a very powerful contribution that you've provided to kind of a learning system for the doctor to evaluate the patient.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Jeff. Actually, I would say that one of the most important questions you can ask any patient is, what was your health like before this illness? When is the last time you felt really well? And then you go to that period of time, which may or may not be closely related to the present illness, and say, okay, well, what was happening in your life before then? What were the things that happened? With people who are chronically ill, who are the main people that are seeking nutritional medicine and integrated medicine approaches, 9 times out of 10, there are significant precipitating events that preceded a change in their health status. And those are things that if you can understand and begin to address, you will be able to be a much more effective practitioner.
I think that's a wonderful closing statement to leave all of our listeners with. And Leo, once again, on behalf of your colleagues, I want to congratulate you for being the recipient of the Year 2000, a very interesting Year 2000 Linus Pauling Functional Medicine Award, and certainly richly deserved from your years of contribution. And I think anyone who is not familiar with you before will be going out immediately and get Power Healing to fill in the gaps in what they need to pick up from your vast contributions in clinical knowledge. So thanks very much, and we hope that we'll continue to periodically check in on this journey that we're all on in the evolution of integrated functional medicine.
Well, I hope so, Jeff. It certainly was a great honor to receive the reward and to be interviewed today.
Thanks very much, and the best to you, and we'll talk to you soon.
Dr. Gallen brought up a very interesting point, actually, obviously a number of interesting points, but one that I want to follow up on is his discussion about magnesium. Magnesium is a mineral that participates, along with other members of the essential mineral family, in modulation of many, many biochemical functions. In fact, it's been said that about 85% of the enzymes in our body require magnesium as one of its cofactors for its function. There are other cofactors from the mineral family, however, that are often common working synergistically with magnesium, one of which is zinc. And I wanted to bring zinc into the limelight here for a second, because often we forget about things that are very clinically valuable and important because we've moved on to new topics, and we assume that everybody must still know about those things that we were talking about or learning 15 or 20 years ago. Zinc is certainly one of those nutrients that deserves continued reinforcement in its clinical importance in practice. Let me just remind you of the important role that zinc plays. Zinc, again, participates in over 2,000 enzymes as a cofactor. Zinc, in terms of dietary need, is comparable to that of iron in the range of about 10 milligrams a day as a level of intake. And yet, where iron is fortified in many foods, zinc is not fortified. And in fact, zinc is removed from most foods by processing because it's found in the highest levels in lean muscle meats or in the exosperm of grains. As we've gotten into fattier diets and into rendered diets and moved to white flour, white sugar products, the zinc level in our diet has gone down. Zinc plays very important roles that very similarly match the physiological endpoint and benchmarks to that of the deficiency of magnesium and essential fatty acids that Dr. Gallen was talking about. Skin problems, hair loss, increased allergic potential, digestive difficulties including chronic irritable bowel syndrome, vitamin A non-responsive night blindness, changes in taste perception, poor wound healing, immune dysfunctions. These are all signs and symptoms of chronic zinc insufficiencies that one might also say, well, gee, those sound reminiscent in some respects to magnesium and essential fatty acid deficiencies. They really go together. And recall there were a number of studies done years ago looking at anorexia nervosa and zinc insufficiency, that the hypothalamic function is dependent upon zinc and the lateral nucleus of the hypothalamus, the appetite control centers, and how it relates to various hormone modulating processes related to hormone balance and appetite are, in fact, zinc interrelated. So this is a very complex nutrient with many influences on physiological function, some of which might be missed in the chronic state as markers of zinc insufficiency if you weren't familiar with this array of functions that zinc has in physiology. There's fortunately a very nice symposium that was recently held on zinc nutrition and physiology, the results of which were then published in the Journal of Nutrition as a supplement. And I would encourage those of you that want to read more about this to get a hold of this issue of the Journal of Nutrition, Volume 130, starting at about page 1407 supplement. There are about 20 articles that are described on the role of zinc in physiology. Let me give you some high points, however, of these articles that might be beneficial for you. First of all, zinc altered immune function and cytokine production. We know that when an individual is zinc insufficient, that the immune system is adversely influenced. Zinc induces cytokine production by isolated leukocytes. Zinc induces monocytes to produce interleukin-1, interleukin-6, and TNF-alpha in peripheral blood mononuclear cells. And what we have in an individual that's zinc insufficient is they can't mount an appropriate immune response to an offending infectious agent or initiator of potential injury. It's now recognized that zinc status must be taken into account whenever there are demonstrations of immune dysfunction
in the individual with poor immune function. This could be either in children or in adults. Recall in children that one of the signs of zinc insufficiency is short growth for age and poor developmental progression. Zinc is a very important nutrient. It participates in one of its functions as a central cofactor in the enzyme DNA-dependent RNA polymerase, which involves the synthesis of messenger RNA. So it's kind of the first step in getting the message off the genome and translating it into protein that's involved within all the array of body functions. So a child that's been raised on junk foods and empty calorie foods is a child that may have zinc insufficiency and may be adversely affected relative to their growth and stature as a consequence. Interestingly enough, what happens as a consequence of zinc insufficiency in children is it alters taste perception, and then the tolerance for sweet goes way up. To get the same sensitivity of the taste of sweet, an individual needs to increase their concentration of sucrose. So that drives them towards sweeter and sweeter beverages and foods, which are lower and lower in zinc. So it's like a dog chasing its tail. The more zinc insufficient, the poorer the taste perception, the more the interest in sweet, and therefore the lower the zinc, and on goes the cycle. This is described very nicely in a variety of papers that have talked about zinc insufficiency as marked by taste perceptions to zinc. As you probably recognize, an individual who cannot taste a 0.1% zinc sulfate solution, it doesn't have a very kind of puckering effect, like an alum effect, is an individual who may be zinc insufficient. This is called the oral zinc tolerance test or taste test. And it's a very simple way of testing for zinc status. It's not a diagnostic determinant, but it's a prognostic screening tool, very simply done, having a person rinse their mouth with a small amount of this zinc sulfate solution and then recording their taste perception. If it tastes just like water, they have no taste to it at all, then one can assume that they're likely to be zinc insufficient and they need then zinc supplementation. We recognize that zinc influences taste and appetite. As I mentioned earlier, this is nicely reviewed in the paper, again in the Journal of Nutrition, Volume 130, page 1493, year 2000, showing that zinc insufficiency creates then an altered taste perception, altered appetite regulatory mechanism, and one of those taste perception differences is to zinc itself. And again, the oral zinc taste test can be a very useful assessment tool. We also recognize that zinc insufficiency reduces insulin sensitivity as well and may have a significant role to play in increasing levels of insulin and ultimately into diabetes and increasing then risk to oxidative stress in diabetics. This was a result of a number of research papers over the past few years, and we recognize that even mild zinc deficiency in animals results in increased oxidant injury, lowered insulin tolerance, and a tendency to shift towards hyperinsulinemia, insulin resistance. So one might put zinc on the list of important nutrients for individuals who have demonstrated clinically insulin resistance or hyperinsulinemia or diabetes, and that if they are low in zinc, that they are then much higher at risk to oxidative stress. In fact, a 3-week supplementation in type 2 postmenopausal diabetic women with 30 milligrams per day of zinc as the glycine chelate, zinc glycinate, showed initially increased levels of, by the way, before they got into the zinc supplementation, these diabetic women had low plasma zinc levels. And by supplementation, their zinc levels came into normal range. And then the measurements of oxidative stress, as looking at DNA damage markers, was significantly reduced after zinc supplementation. I wonder, urge you when you do zinc supplementation to try to keep within the upper limit of about 50 milligrams per day. As you get to 100 or more milligrams elemental zinc per day, you run the risk of depressing HDL. This is work done, published by Dr. Prasad a number of years ago. One needs to be somewhat cognizant of the fact that a little is good, but too much may not be better. There's this curvilinear dose-response relationship that we've discussed. And I think up to 50 milligrams elemental zinc a day can be used safely in individuals to improve zinc status. When you get above that, one needs to look at the lipoprotein patterns, particularly HDL to LDL ratios. There are some therapeutic approaches using zinc supplementation that you use as high as 220 milligrams a day of elemental zinc. But again, I urge the clinician to follow the HDL-LDL ratio in those cases where very high doses of zinc are being used. We also recognize in individuals with HIV infection and opportunistic infections as a consequence of HIV that zinc status is very important and can help to improve immune function and lower the risk of opportunistic infections. The relationship of zinc to thymulin and thymus function is clearly identified. Extensive work has been done in France on the interrelationship between HIV, thymulin, thymus function, and zinc. And therefore, one also should be very concerned, I think, in individuals who have a immunodeficiency symptom or syndrome and look at their zinc status and replete zinc where necessary. And lastly, there's an emerging view that this oxidative stress connection that I've described with inappropriate zinc intake or status may also increase the risk in genetically susceptible individuals to Alzheimer's disease. This is a new information suggesting that beta-amyloid protein undergoes the scission that leads to these amyloid fragments that may correlate themselves with Alzheimer's disease as a consequence, in part, of poor zinc metabolism, zinc status, and altered zinc economy in the body. So just to put zinc on the marquee, you'll notice it has a variety of different very important roles to play in physiological function and should be worked and looked along the same lines as magnesium and essential fatty acids. Lastly, Dr. Gallen spoke about the important role of gut ecology, and he was the first to really coin and use the term dysbiosis. I think it's a very wonderful description of a whole host of different physiological things that are going on. I want you to recall that one can improve gut ecology by dietary intervention. Favorable gut flora can reduce the relative risk of things like inflammatory bowel disease. This is recently described in the Journal of Parenteral and Enteral Nutrition, Volume 24, page 189 in the year 2000, in which recent evidence suggests that the composition of colonic microflora plays a role in intestinal inflammation in things like IBD. If one can then restore proper flora and limit or resolve dysbiosis, that one then has a lowered immunopotentiation in the gut and a lowered risk to IBD. One can do this by what we have commonly called the 4R program, and you've heard it so many times it's probably become a mantra, and that is the Remove, Replace, Reinoculate, Repair program. And there are a variety of nutritional agents as prebiotics and probiotics that will improve then gut floral disposition and help to treat dysbiosis. Inulin is one that's coming up very quickly on the radar screen. There's a very nice paper in the Journal of Nutrition, Volume 130, page 1197 in the year 2000, talking about different inulin fragments, different molecular weight inulin fragments. These are the oligosaccharide fragments as contrasted to FOS that are shorter fragments. Inulin are longer chain link, non-digestible fiber materials that then have a very powerful prebiotic effect and help to increase then the formation of the friendly bacteria at the expense of getting rid of the unfriendly dysbiotic bacteria. So Acidophilus and bifidobacteria supplementation and inulin supplementation simultaneously provides one component. This is the reinoculate component of the 4R program. Once again, I thank you for being with us in the month of September. We started back into the new academic year and look forward to what I think is going to be a very exciting fall with regard to functional medicine.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by the Institute for Functional Medicine, Incorporated, located in Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.